All right, we're in CLR world. How's it going? Introduce yourself. Who are you?
My name is Moni Stevens, and I'm the dev owner of the Garbage Collector in CLR.
Excellent. Patrick talked about you when I interviewed about a year and a half ago with him, so we have a lot of questions for you.
Okay.
Good.
And I'm Andrew Pardo. I'm the PM owner of the GC. Patrick didn't talk about me a year ago.
I'm sure he inferred you.
No, I'm actually just on the team a couple of years. So.
Perfect. So let's jump right into it. CLR4, third iteration of the GC. What's going on? What's new? What should people be excited about? Let's get the marketing stuff out of the way.
Really, the biggest feature I'd say that we have for the GC and CLR4 is the concurrent GC has been upgraded to what we're referring to as the background GC. Mm. And the nice thing about this is it's going to hide the latency on user machines a lot more.
So what happens? So we talked about that before, and with the advent of many core and everyone's freaking out about 100 cores in the not too distant future on the client. Mm-hmm. What did you do? So essentially, what does that mean?
So concurrent GC was designed in 1.0. Actually, it came out in 1.0 since day one of CLR. So that was there because we wanted UI apps to be interactive. UI apps, they don't, when user click on something or, when you refresh something, you don't want to see the flickering and that kind of effect. So it was designed to have shorter latency than, what we call a blocking GC.
Okay.
So what a blocking GC means that, when a GC happens, it needs to suspend all your managed threads, and then it does its work, then it resumes all the managed threads.
Okay.
And concurrent GC actually does that suspension and resumption a couple of times, and the rest of the GC, while concurrent GC is going on, it can actually allow the user threads to run.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you shorter pause times.
Okay.
And concurrent GC is only for full GCs. So ephemeral GCs, which means Gen 0, Gen 1 GCs, they're always blocking GCs.
Okay.
So then now the situation has changed quite a bit because, when a few years back when I started working on GC, when people had like 100 megabyte managed heap, and you would say like, oh, you have so much data in your managed heap, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about gigs of managed heap, right? People are like, I have a 4 gig managed heap, and so the pause time that was that they started observing started to become an issue even with concurrent GC, right? Because concurrent GC has some limitations on its design that would introduce the longer pause times.
Sure.
And background GC was designed to mitigate that. It's actually an evolution on top of concurrent GC.
Beautiful.
So background GC actually. The most significant difference between background GC and concurrent GC is a concurrent GC, when it's in progress, no other GCs can happen. So, you can allocate, right? That's how you are allowed to run concurrently with the GC.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do any other GCs, which means, if you're allocating, for example, small objects on the ephemeral segment,
mm-hmm.
where Gen 0 and Gen 1 live on,
mm-hmm.
you can allocate, the most you can allocate is, kind of to the end of that segment. So, segment is, in the current release, and don't, rely on this number because we might change it in, service packs. But currently for 32-bit operating systems, we have a 16 meg segment for workstation GC.
Mm.
And, you're pretty much allowed to allocate at most 16 megs minus what you already had when concurrent GC started on the ephemeral segment.
Okay.
Right? So that's a big limitation because, you keep allocating and then at some point we're saying like, you've allocated enough and we're going to stop you. So we're going to suspend your thread next time you try to allocate.
Mm.
And in effect, that's the same as, if we were doing a block in GC and we suspended you, because you're a managed thread. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big limitation. There's other, kind of design limitations in concurrent GC. So we wanted to kind of make that much better for, shorter pause times and just performance in general. So we designed this thing we called background GC. And background GC actually allows you to do ephemeral GCs while a background GC is in progress.
Excellent.
So that kind of opens up a new territory for you, right? Because...
Mm-hmm.
if you were only allocating temporary data, then Gen 0 and Gen 1 GCs hopefully will just get rid of all the garbage that you've created while the background GC is in progress. And then you're, you know, you can sustain that mode forever, right? So then, you know, you can say, oh, I can always allow your threads to run, right? Background GC also needs to pause the EE, you know, which means, you know, it'll suspend the main thread and resume them one time during the duration of a background GC, but that's about it. So ideally, you know, the rest of the time you can just keep running. So that was the most significant advantage of background GC.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So just to kind of sum that up really quickly, what stopped your threads from running with concurrent GC is when you ran out of space to allocate. If you can't allocate, your program can't continue unless it's not trying to do any allocations. Mm. Background GC, you can continue to clean up your ephemeral segment, so you can keep allocating on your ephemeral segment, and your program can keep running.
That's awesome.
So it's pretty cool. It's great work.
Absolutely. I mean, it's basically asynchronous GC, right?
That's right.
Yes.
You just use the term background.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Asynchronous sounds cooler. Excellent. So async GC. Now, one of the questions I'd ask now, on the server, of course, you guys have always had, as you mentioned, concurrent GC, which makes sense in a server environment.
Actually, concurrent GC was only for workstation GC.
So what was going on in the server version?
So server, the background GC that comes out in V4 is only for workstation because, you know, it's kind of built on top of concurrent GC, which was only built on for workstation GC, right?
Okay.
Because, you know, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, that, you know, it was designed for UI apps. Those are like desktop apps.
Sure.
So server GC was designed for high throughput and high scalability because, you know, it can do collections on multiple heaps. So
sure.
Instead of doing, you know, GC work on just one thread, now it can do it on 8 threads if you have 8 processors. Right?
Sure.
So that kind of is how we achieve that. So right now, we in V4, we don't have background GC for server yet, but the work that we did for workstation GC is actually the foundation for when we start to do work for server GC, because a lot of the work that will be carried over, but you know, server GC has its own complications that we'll have to deal with when we do the background GC, you know, on server.
Sure.
So that's what we're going to do, hopefully, in the next.
Excellent. You know, so I guess really what I was asking, so so what you're saying is in CLR V4 GC, on the server, you haven't done very much work in the performance and collection area?
Actually, there are some things we've done in V4, but really I think the most notable thing for the server GC in the current time frame, it's cheating a little bit because we actually put this in 3.5 SP1, but there's something called full GC notifications.
Mm.
And what that is if you've got a server that's set up with, if your company setup is that you've got a lot of similar servers with like a Cisco router that's routing requests to them, any one of those machines takes a GC, it's going to have a slight pause, right? And it's not going to take requests. So we've created a notification that the GC will tell you when there's going to be a collection coming, a full collection coming. And you can have your router start routing to the other servers. And when the GC finishes, it tells your router, hey, I'm ready for work again. So you can actually completely hide your latency in a server farm like this just by adding another piece of hardware to it, which if you're talking about businesses like this, that's nothing.
Yeah.
So cool. That's really great. That was 3.5 SP1, so people can actually use that now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably more significant than, or more noticeable than the work we did in V4. We did some V4 tuning work on server, like the 128-way work and such.
Excellent.
Right. That's when, you know, our OS groups that
just a little thing, you know.
Just a little thing.
128-way.
Support, you know, 64 plus PROG.
Okay.
You know, we had to make some changes in server GC to accommodate for that. Because before, you know, people didn't think that we would be on, you know, 128-core machines, right? So then we had to do some work to increase kind of the scalability there.
Now, you guys, this is just a question. I've been doing some interviews with, of course, Windows 7 released today. Well, now people know we interviewed this, so I gave it away. All right, so now you know, Niners. work that Arun Kishan has done in removing basically the, you know, the dispatcher lock and mm-hmm. the kernel.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that's going to have positive impacts for you guys. When you program on Windows 7.
Sure. I mean, I think that's kind of beneficial for anybody who needs, you know, to, you know, schedule threads, you know, to do multi-threaded work.
Yeah.
Which we do very frequently in Server GC. Yeah. Right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So that should have, you know, pretty excellent implications for you guys mm-hmm. as you move along.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, we all understand now how background GC works, or asynchronous GC, but what did you do? How does it really work? Like, what's going on? Can you draw some pictures? Or
sure.
That would be nice. Absolutely. Whiteboarding is fun.
Okay.
Unlike waterboarding. All right. Pop this guy up. Great.
So, I'm going to draw a picture for concurrent GC first,
okay.
and then you can, you know, kind of compare that with how background GC works, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when concurrent GC happens, let's say here's your, you have two segments, right? Here's your Gen 2 segment, here's your terminal segment. So let's say, you know, this is your two objects, you have some two objects here, one object here, and zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's your three generations. So when concurrent GC starts, right, so we say, well, we're going to be collecting everything, you know, from here up until here. So, you know, that's your kind of your concurrent GC domain, right? This is what you decide to collect. So then, you know, concurrent GC would start do its work, you know, which includes, you know, marking your various routes, right? This includes stack and GC handles, and perhaps something else, right? So it does this concurrently, right? There's a concurrent marking. And then at some point, so all this is going on while, you know, the user threads are allocating, right? So you can allocate here. So and then at some point, we'll say, you know, we'll suspend E, and, you know, it's going to do some more marking that's non-concurrent. And then, so during this time frame, you know, you can't allocate, right? Then we'll say, we'll restart E, and then you can allocate again. Right, then concurrent GC will say, well, I'm going to do more work here, which is, you know, like some other GC work, right? Then I'm going to suspend the E again. So during this time frame, you know, before next time we'll call restart E, what we do is, you know, you've already allocated some, right? Like right here, you're allowed to allocate some. So this part will say, you know, we'll promote what you've allocated, you know, that delta to Gen 1. So essentially, you know, we don't actually mark, you know, try to find garbage in this, you know, part that you've just allocated
mm-hmm.
while you're allowed to allocate concurrently with the GC. We'll just promote that whole thing to Gen 1. So that's kind of another limitation on concurrent GC, which is, you know, you actually can't clean up this part that you just allocated, right? So then it's going to do that, and then that's kind of, you know, allocate again. You can allocate that while we're kind of sweeping the heap. And by the way, so concurrent GC always sweeps the heap, which
mm-hmm.
means, you know, it'll make free lists out of the garbage it finds on the heap, right?
Okay.
So that's kind of the picture for concurrent GC. And as we can see that, you know, when we talked about this a little while ago, that you can only allocate up, you know, the most up until here. You know, there's a little bit of room we leave, but, you know, pretty much this is what you can allocate. So as soon as you've allocated that much, then, you know, you'll have to be suspended. So that's a, you know, limitation of concurrent GC. Now, the picture for background GC you can allocate here, and you can also do Gen 0 and Gen 1 GCs. Right? So you've allocated some, right? Then we say, oh, it's time to do a Gen 0 GC, which means, you know, we set this allocation limit on each generation, and when that allocation limit gets exceeded, it means a GC will be triggered on that generation, right? So it works the same way for Gen 0, Gen 1, or Gen 2.
Okay.
For Gen 0, for Gen 1 and Gen 2, allocating into these generations just means you promote the survivors from its younger generation into that generation. So they all have an allocation limit. So, you know, when you've allocated enough that that Gen 0 limit gets exceeded, then we'll say, well, then we'll trigger a Gen 0 GC. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, you can imagine, you know, this ephemeral segment can just, you know, kind of go up a bit, and then after you've done the Gen 0 and Gen 1 GC, it can, you know, kind of retract some. And if needed, we can also expand the heap, which means, you know, we'll actually acquire a new segment if needed. Like, you know, if you've allocated too much, like up until here, and you also, you know, you have more data to survive, then we'll say, you know, we'll expand the heap. So this happens in a Gen 1 GC. And by the way, when you need to expand the heap on the small object heap, you always have to do a GC to achieve that. So, you know, you actually have to say, you know, I'm doing a GC, and during this GC I detected that, you know, my heap is too full, you know, the ephemeral segment is too full. So I need to acquire a new segment and then make that new segment the new ephemeral segment. So this guy will become, you know, a Gen 2 segment. Right, then you have a new segment here. That's your new ephemeral segment. So then, you know, you can just kind of sustain this, you know, mode for ideally, you know, for as long as background GC needs to run.
Yeah.
Right. So there's, you know, obviously a lot of kind of complications when we go from, you know, not allowing you to do a GC to allowing you to do a GC, right?
Yes.
I can give you a simple example.
Okay.
This is a very simple example in one of the kind of the issues that we have to solve. So we have this heap verification feature in SLS. So, you know, for those of you who use, like, you know, WinDebug or CDB, and you use our debug extension called Son of Strike. So, you know, it's called SLS. So SLS has a command that's called verify heap. So what this does is, you know, it goes through the heap linearly and verifies that, you know, each object looks same. So inside of the GC, we also have this, you know, functionality that we can turn on while we're, you know, during the development cycle to, you know, if I make a change, I want to, you know, make sure that the heap looks same. So I would turn on that feature. It does pretty much the same thing as this verify heap command.
Okay.
Right. So what verification means is, you know, when I'm going linearly on this segment, right, here's my segment, and these are my objects. So they could be object 1, 2, and maybe there's a free object. There's, you know, 3, 4, right? So it goes like that. So I'm going to go linearly and say, like, get the next object. I'm going to verify two things. One is the object itself looks same, right? So that's number one, which means, you know, the method table looks reasonable. You know, if you have a sync block, you know, the values in the sync block are corresponding to the correct, you know, maybe sync block entries if you have one, that sort of thing. Right?
Cool. So it's reliable. It's
right, exactly.
Predictable, reasonable.
We know what each the attributes of an object is like, and we want to make sure that those attributes look right.
Okay.
Right? So the second thing it does is, you know, actually goes through the members. In other words, you know, the references, the, you know, the references this object contains, and it's going to verify that those references look same, right?
Mm-hmm.
So apparently, you can't have a valid object that has a reference to a free object. That's invalid, right? So that's what this guy does.
Okay.
But, you know, if you think about how background GC works, well, in background GC, if I were in the sweep phase, right? So I have, let's say, three segments, Gen 2, and ephemeral, right? So I'm going to go linearly, object by object, on the heap, and make free lists out of any objects that are not marked, right? Which means they're garbage. So, you know, if I'm going 01, 02, 03, 03, and 01, 03, 04, right? So I'm going to go this way, and then I say, like, oh, these guys are free, so I'm going to make a free object out of those. Right, then I'm keep going, and then maybe there's more, so I'm going to make more free objects. Right? So then, you know, I'm going to go linearly with each segment. So let's say that, you know, you're going to do a heap verification, like, while I'm here, right? Like, this is where the background GC is at the moment.
Okay.
So I say, now I want to verify the heap. Well, let's say, you know, this O1 guy has a reference to this guy, and this O2 guy has a reference to this guy, right? So it may have references to other guys, but that's... But before we... Sorry. I'm going to make this correct, actually. So we're here, right, at the beginning of this Gen 2 segment. So, since we're here, we haven't discovered that O1 should actually be a free object. You know, it should actually be free, which means it's not marked. If it were marked, that would be incorrect, because it would actually have a reference to a free object.
So right? It would be insane.
Right, exactly. So, but you know, since we haven't actually checked whether this object is marked or not, this object still looks like a normal, valid object to you. Right? Uh-huh. So then you can't really do this stuff. Because, you know, if you go to its members, you know, the heap verification is going to, you know, freak out and say, like, oh, but you have a valid object that points to a free object. That's incorrect. We don't allow that.
Okay.
Right? So that's, like, kind of a simple example that we had to work with to make heap verification work again. Right? Because of the background GC feature that, you know, if this stuff had to be modified and we had to check, like, where is background GC at the moment?
Mm.
And then if you're going through any object in the portion of the heap that background GC has already went through, then it means any objects there, if it's a valid object, then it's truly a valid object.
Sure.
But if it's in a portion that background GC hasn't gone through, you know, even if it looks like a valid object, it could later on be made into part of a free list item, right? Mm. A free object. So that's one example of, you know, what we have to do to make this feature work.
Do you think there are other sort of applications out there or tools that are, you know, are in the sequential mindset and aren't really prepared to understand that there's just going to be a lot of asynchronous stuff going on that they used to be able to depend on not being asynchronous? Besides, like, these tools?
No, I think this actually is, you know, a very transparent feature to users.
Great.
There shouldn't be any kind of adverse effect that they have to deal with. That's one of the advantages of working on GC, right? I don't really cause users...
Stuff just gets faster and they don't mind.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But, I mean, in the case that you just showed, that there was a tool...
Right, so, you know, obviously this SOS command will have to be modified to, you know, accommodate for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Perfect. Good, man. So have you been doing some benchmarks? You guys?
Yeah, we have a suite of perf tests that we run. Some of them are micro benchmarks. Mm. Others are kind of scenarios that we adopt from our partner teams, like ASP.NET and, you know, some client teams scenarios. Mm. So we ran them on the background GC feature, and we got very good results. And actually, we even ran it on one of our external customer scenario, because... We had their scenario set up in our lab, so we tried out background GC compared with concurrent GC, and we saw very good results there.
Perfect.
There's much fewer, you know, large pause times, and each large pause times were smaller than when we're using concurrent GC.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, it's a little bit confusing, because when you think about the term concurrent, right? Concurrency, I mean, and then you have parallelism and concurrency. They don't always mean the same thing, but in general, they do mean that you have two things operating at the same time, right?
Yeah.
And so when you say concurrent GC, it's good that now people understand, as you corrected me earlier, that it's been there since V1.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was sort of a research kind of topic, because I see a lot of papers on the complexity.
Oh, there's a lot of papers on concurrent GC, yeah.
It's a hard problem.
Mm-hmm. It is a hard problem.
And so you still have concurrent GC, but
right.
You've added a background.
Background GC replaces concurrent GC. Cool. Because, you know, it is kind of the new generation of concurrently running GCs, right?
Sure.
So I guess, you know, the reason we call it background is because now we have foreground GCs, which are Gen 0 and Gen 1 GCs, right? We call those foreground GCs.
Cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Very interesting. So you haven't said much yet. Start talking. I'm just kidding.
She knows more about the background GC.
Sure. So, I mean, you guys, I mean, these are interesting, these are good features, and they're going to benefit, you know, developers. I mean, not many developers actually program against the GC directly.
No,
nor should they.
Well, they can call it GC.collect, right?
Users will notice that their programs will become, will have lower latencies. So users will see fewer pause times. And developers will, of course, take advantage of that.
Now, so you guys added this new feature. Typically, when you add features like this, there is the notion of scale. You mentioned you did some work for 128 cores, processors. But, you know, that's, you're going to have 128 processors on, you know, your laptop in about, I don't know, 5 years?
5 years, maybe, yes.
Okay, so maybe 500. How does that impact your guys when you think about the future, when you're designing this stuff? You're like, whoa, man, it's so, you know.
Yeah.
So I was just going to say, we were actually talking about the 4096 processor scenario.
Yes.
Because technically we could do 64-way, 64-core, but we haven't been tuning for that quite yet.
Sure. Interesting.
Yeah, so multi-core is definitely something on our minds.
Yeah.
So we've kind of chatted about interesting ideas that we can do to actually take advantage of so many cores, right? Because the problem is, you know, it's... Nowadays, you know, the number of cores can go up really rapidly, but how software can actually take advantage of those cores, that's actually a big problem.
Absolutely.
Right? That's why we have, you know, projects like Link that's to help people take advantage of those cores, right? Mm-hmm. Because for an average developer, you know, having to think about, you know, scheduling threads on all those cores and dealing with synchronization issues efficiently, that's a huge task, right?
Absolutely.
And we don't want them to be wasting time on that either. That's kind of our job.
That's your job.
Right, exactly. So for GC, we want to actually be able to take advantage of those when they, you know, come out, which means we need to start working on them before
Absolutely.
That happens, right?
Agreed.
So, you know, you can, you know, think of ideas like, you know, how do you perhaps, you know, dedicate a few cores of your so many cores to just doing the GC work, so we can always do GCs in the background, right? So that kind of thing. So we've been kind of thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we'll have to do something very soon, because, you know, they're coming online pretty soon, I think.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays, 64 cores is still kind of a challenge to even set up and run.
Yeah,
I think.
It's kind of a rare machine.
Right.
We don't even have many of them to run on here.
But you have a 24, you know, 24-way machine.
We've got
right?
24s and 32s and 48, but we have to share 64s right now, and the 128s aren't that easy to get time on.
Yeah.
I could only imagine.
Yeah.
They're a little pricey.
Yeah. But I mean, in fact, the fact of the matter is, I mean, the average developer, most of us general purpose developers, we're not, you know, doing supercomputing. We don't really know what we can build with 128 cores at our disposal. We don't really have the tools that can help us, that enable us to do something really incredible. It's way out there.
But SQL knows what to do with it today.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. And
they love
SQL
cores.
SQL is very important. So really our whole 64-plus processor work was driven by SQL and Windows.
Interesting. So let's talk about that. I mean, SQL on Windows, they use fibers. They're all native code. But they use managed code so they can reason
SQL's
about
getting
I.O.
more and more managed code. One of the biggest changes, the SQL they just shipped, SQL 10, we've had managed stored procedures in SQL since 2005.
Yes.
UConn.
UConn, yeah. But Katmai, SQL 10 is the first time that SQL has ever started using managed code inside the SQL system itself.
Interesting.
So a lot of the SQL management system is going to be written in managed code in the SQL that is shipping now or just about shipped.
Sure.
I'm not really sure about their schedule.
That's okay.
So we actually expect that there's going to be a huge uptick in SQL programmers using managed code. Because when SQL starts to use it in their own database, it's kind of an endorsement that, hey, this stuff works. This stuff works in our scenario.
Sure.
So CLR and SQL is going to be, SQL's going to be a much bigger customer for us in the future. And they always have been, but they're going to stay that way.
Excellent. It kind of reminds me of Chris Broom's kind of epic blog posts about hosting.
Yes.
So I should talk to somebody about hosting, because I have a bunch of these interviews I've been doing, but I haven't talked to anyone about work that's been done in the hosting environment.
So shared hosting is a big scenario for the CLR. ASP.NET's a major customer for us. It's possibly the place where managed code is used more than anywhere else. And we did some work in the GC to help shared hosting scenarios with the AppDomain resource monitoring. AppDomain's, you know, the isolation units for managed code. And shared host, if you picture, just to use ASP.NET as an example, if you picture a hosting shop that's got, say, 50 different websites running on one machine, each one's running inside of a different AppDomain. Your server slows down, something's going wrong, you need to know which website is bad. You need to know which website you can kill. Previously, ASP.NET had some heuristics, but they didn't have a lot of insight into what was happening inside of the CLR. So we did a feature this summer to allow you to determine how much processor a given app domain is using, and how much memory it's allocating, how much memory it has that survived the last collection. So you can get to this through managed code or hosting APIs or ETW, however you want, but you're able to actually look at a hosting process, look at every individual program, or every app domain, if an app domain is isolated to a program, then every individual program, and determine what resources it's using so you can determine who the bad actors are and take care of them.
Cool.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a long requested features from people, because, you know, if you look at performance counters, right, you can get a bunch of counter values off of each process. Like, you know, you can get like the work and set, peak work and set, private bytes, all sort of good stuff, you know, from processes. But then, you know, we have this app domain thing, right, you know, that we recommend to people as an isolation mechanism. But, you know, there wasn't exactly a way to get performance characteristics off of app domains. So we decided to add those in V4. It's also a new feature in V4. So I, you know, I'm glad that we kind of filled in that hole.
It's important.
We started to fill in that hole. Yeah.
Right. Excellent.
Yeah, she said started. There is actually probably a lot more we could have done with this. We started with the things that ASP.NET wanted.
The CPU and memory and those are the two most.
So what are some of the kind of big unresolved problems for you when you think about when you look? You know, wow, I mean, you're going to have a lot of employment.
So I think the next big thing we're looking at, obviously, is kind of to make background GC work on servers, right? Because that's actually really where the biggest gain we're going to see, right? Because desktop applications, you know, that use workstation GC, they're unlikely ever going to have as big heaps as server applications have, right? So, you know, server apps, you know, they can go up to, you know, many gigs of, you know, but desktop apps, you know, I mean, they can go big, but, you know, not quite that big. So really, the work that we did in V4 is, you know, meant as a foundation for making it work. So server apps will see shorter latency. That's really the ultimate goal for that.
Cool. Now, there's also this other little thing that we've been talking about for 2 years now called Silverlight, which, of course, also has your GC in it.
The same GC.
The question, it has the same GC as the client GC.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. It doesn't have concurrent GC on Macs, because Mac doesn't have the OS feature that we need to make concurrent GC work.
Cool.
So
you have one source tree.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Core CLR is the same as the desktop CLR. It's built from the same source base.
Cool. Just has less of the unnecessary BCL stuff in it, so they can actually make it
there
smaller.
There are some features that don't make sense. Comment or up, for example, doesn't make sense in a web scenario. Definitely, we factored the frameworks down.
Sure.
There's a number of things we did, like Mounty mentioned, with the Mac. We don't have concurrent GC on the Mac because there are
Power
some
PC
issues. It's not actually, the Core CLR is supported on the Intel Mac only, so it's 10.4 and later of Intel Mac.
Okay.
We didn't do a PowerPC port because Apple dropped PowerPC 3 years ago, so one day all Mac users will be using Intel.
All right.
It should happen someday soon. It just seemed like a lot of work for something that was going to be a disappearing market.
Sure, understood.
But there are some things that we did that we really tried to make sure that Silverlight on the Mac felt like a Mac app rather than a Microsoft app sitting on a Mac. Because, you know, Mac's got their whole feel of things. I mean, stuff has to look like Cocoa and has to be cool and Steve Jobsy. We want to make sure that
it has to be well-designed and smooth. And
for example, there's a bug in the Mac localization tables where they've got the start date of the Islamic calendar wrong. And Silverlight on the Mac has the start date of the Islamic calendar wrong. So that it's just the same as we're just exposing Mac's bug all the way right through Silverlight, which is the right thing to do. Because if it's something else, like, you know, they happen to sort in a particular language in a particular way because it's ambiguous and that's the choice that Mac made, well, we should stick with Mac's choice. We're just a Mac app. But really, it is the same CLR code base on the desktop and the Mac.
Excellent. So now back to like CLR running on you know, the standard Microsoft PC configuration. With CLR 4, you guys, the CLR team, have also created this side-by-side in proc kind of thing. Where so how does that work in your world? So how does that impact what you do?
Do you want to take
this? Don't. She's, Moni starts shaking. Don't say side-by-side.
Side-by-side, no. Yeah. All right. So the INPROC side-by-side, it's really easy to see why we did that for Silverlight, for example, because you have to be able to have browsers already host .NET, or you could have a managed browser, and you have to be able to put the Silverlight core CLR inside the same process as a full desktop CLR. So that's just a shoo-in. There's no question we needed it there. The reason we need it on desktop is more of a compatibility issue. We try really hard to make sure that every version of the CLR is compatible with the previous version. But there's only so much you can do. There's a great story that one of our, the guy who owns the INPROC side-by-side effort tells. When we shipped, I think it was 1.1 to 2.0 or 1.0 to 1.1, there was an Outlook add-in that was being used by executives. A whole exec team installed this Outlook add-in. And this thing was written in managed code. It was written by an intern. And it had a race condition. They were starting 8 threads. And as soon as they started the thread, they set some thread data. And that's backwards. So on 1.0, that was fine. Because our thread startup was kind of slow. And, I mean, it wasn't bad, but it was kind of slow. Start up the thread, set the data, thread goes off, no problem. 1.1, we improved our thread startup performance. Start up the thread, start up the next thread, set the data for the first thread, you got problems. So there was a week when the Microsoft IT services pushed 1.1 down on everybody's machines, and suddenly none of the execs could read their email.
Yes.
And if you know anything about Microsoft, when an exec can't do work, none of us can do anything.
Exactly.
Really. We just sit around and twiddle our thumbs. Yeah. So anyway, this was a big problem. This just goes to show that you can't get perfect compatibility because people rely upon behavior that's not a contracted behavior. It's not part of our implementation interface that we say, hey, we're going to guarantee that the thread is going to take 4 microseconds to start. You know, we can improve that perf to 2 microseconds, and that's not breaking our contract with the developer. So the idea of side-by-side is let every app run against the version of the CLR it was built against.
Sure.
And if you build, if you want to have, say, Office running with a framework that's got version 4.0, but you want to run a plugin that is built against version 2.0, like maybe it's a, not that you have a printer driver plugin that's managed, but you know, a printer driver for a printer that hasn't been manufactured in 5 years and you have to run this 2.0 code, go ahead. We'll load the 2.0 code, we'll load the 4.0 code, load the 2.0 CLR, run the 2.0 code against that, run the 4.0 code against the 4.0 CLR, perfect compatibility.
Sure, and there's no way that they can see each of the other's memory, so it really doesn't matter. It's two different instances of the
two different instances of CLR.
Right.
Sure.
Perfect app isolation, and if you need to communicate between them, you use standard remoting or COM or whatever you're doing already.
Cool, and if you have a 2.0 app, like many people will, and you can just compile it against 4.0 and deal with all the little bugs that may come up and then run it on your GC and you get back
sure,
on GC.
Sure, if you recompile with 4.0, yeah.
Yep. Cool. Excellent. Very cool. Well, hey, say hi to Patrick. Tell him to write some code. Yeah. Does he write code anymore?
He does.
No?
He does.
Yeah. He's a big shot now, technical fellow, man.
He doesn't write code for your GC.
We can't talk about what he's writing code for.
You can't talk about what he's writing code for, but he sticks his thumb in some
pots. I'm playing. Of course he does. Great job. It's good to finally get you on camera, Moni. We've heard a lot about you.
Oh, thank you.
The you know, the face of the CLR that no one's seen. Now they see it. There it is. And nice to meet you, too.
It's nice to meet
great
you.
Great job. Welcome to CLR World.
Thank you. It's great fun here.
Totally, it's been fun going around.
6 years in C++, this is quite a
Oh my god, you're just like Brandon Bray, man. What are you
actually, I worked with
Welcome
Brandon
to the dark
years.
Side.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you know, it's actually cool, right?
Yeah,
but,
it's
I mean,
a lot
you
of
guys
fun.
All work in C++, so yeah, sure, you're on the CLR team, but you don't write managed code, do you? Except for your tests.
Right, the APIs are in managed code, but that's a very small part of my job.
Of course. So, yeah. You're writing in native.
Yep.
Being a PM, I've actually had to stop writing C++ and start writing managed code, so I spent a while learning C#. I actually wrote some samples in VB last week. It was difficult, but fun. Mm. So this has been a real shift for me.
Cool.
But you know, coming from the native world, my real desire is to make the CLR faster,
okay,
and you know, more performant. Get some of the characteristics that we had in native, because
mm-hmm.
It's a great technology. And if it can just close that gap with native, then we're really onto something.
Absolutely, that's a serious challenge, especially I mean with the garbage collector, right?
Actually, with the garbage collector, that's perhaps one of the exceptions. I think I don't know if you've heard, like a while ago, you know. One of our perf architects, you know, he did this kind of little contest with Raymond Chen. So, you know, they both did, you know, some memory allocations in their tests, right? And they tried to compare if the native heap allocator is faster or the GC allocator heap is faster.
Mm.
And in the end, so they went back and forth. Both, you know, kind of Raymond did a lot of work to improve his app. You can see this on his blog.
Excellent.
So, you know, eventually his test was a little bit faster. But he said, you know, the amount of work that I had to do to get to this point was just
ridiculous.
You know, yeah, right. And the, you know, the our perf archetype, he didn't really do much. He just wrote something. Right?
Yeah.
So our allocator actually is very fast.
That's one of the really nice things about garbage collected memory is that segmented allocators are really fast. And, you know, like Mani's saying, you can write a segmented allocator in native code, and you can beat the performance of the GC segmented allocator because you're targeting this just for your particular scenario. You know how big the allocations are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets back to, like, when I was on the C team, I was on the Itanium, and I can always write better assembly than the optimizing compiler. Just take the optimizing compiler's output, tweak it a little bit, I'm done.
Mm.
So you can write better in native, but is it worth the pain?
Well, also, I mean, RGC is kind of, it should be handling many, many different scenarios, right?
Yeah.
It's not to handle, like, a specific benchmark, so we tune RGC to that small benchmark to win at that benchmark.
Mm.
We really are targeting, you know, millions of our users. You know, they could be in any scenario that you can imagine.
Absolutely.
So RGC is meant to work with, you know, tons of different scenarios without any knobs that you have to tune.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's actually a very, very significant advantage of RGC.
Absolutely. Now, is there any thinking? I mean, that's great. I mean, Microsoft is all about general purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So in your case, I mean, do you ever find there's customers that actually want to get into the CLR and do some Raymond Chen kind of work
mm-hmm.
with the GC, which they really shouldn't have to, but do you provide any inroads?
We've definitely heard people that say that they wanted to do that, but every time I looked at their scenario, it turned out that, you know, it's always something that, you know, it's really like a two-parts work, right? You know, one is what you can do in your application, and that should not include how to tune the GC, because tuning the GC is our job,
sure,
right? So in your application, what you can do to understand your allocation pattern, that's a you know, user task. Right,
sure.
If you would. And then the rest of the part is, you know, we look at a wide range of scenarios, and we kind of write RGC to adapt to all those scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, really, you know, as a user of the CLR, you should never need to want to kind of tune the CLR GC in a particular way.
Sure.
Because, you know, we've, you know, I've personally looked at a lot of scenarios. It's always, you know, occasionally it's something that I've had to do in the GC to handle their scenario because it's a situation that we didn't expect before. But most of the time it's really just, you know, you look at the user allocation pattern, then you change some of that pattern to, you know, make GC perform better for you.
Sure, and I guess a lot of the people that were, I mean, it's the canonical argument that we were all having, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago now, about, you know, really not having deterministic finalization.
Mm-hmm.
I could kill an object, but it's not really dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm assuming that I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I mean, that is related to GC, mm-hmm. right? I mean, because GC calls collect, and you're supposed to free this object. It doesn't exist anymore. However, my application, for some reason, thinks it's still alive because it right. appears to be alive, but it isn't.
Right. Finalization is kind of, there's two parts in finalization. One part is inside of the GC. That's how, you know, we actually manage the finalizable objects for you, like, you know, determine when they're ready for finalization. Mm-hmm. The other part is actually the finalizer, you know, the thread proc, the thread procedure, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where we apply kind of a bunch of policies on top of, you know, the actual implementation and say, like, you know, when do we decide to time out a finalizer if it's not, you know, getting executed, or, you know, when do we want to time out the whole, you know, thread proc, you know, if we're at process exit, you know, that kind of thing. So I think from the user point of view, there's also kind of two parts. You know, one is you have a finalizable object when it gets finalized, right? You know, which means that implicates some limitations on what you can do in the finalizer. So mm-hmm. we recommend to you that you shouldn't do anything crazy, right, you know, in the finalizer. You know, mm-hmm. the appropriate amount of work is for you to release the native resource, right? But there's also another aspect, which is, you know, the what we call the dispose pattern. That's, I think, you know, we have like maybe at least 10 pages that talk about dispose pattern in our design guidelines. So that's another thing that you have to do to ensure that, you know, you're programming correctly based mm-hmm. on how finalization behaves.
Sure. So that's that goes back to I haven't talked to them for a while, but Christoph Kulinka his buddy. I'm sorry that I forgot.
Brian A.
Yeah.
Brad Abrams.
Yeah. Sorry, Brad. I haven't talked to him for years, so he knows that I know who he is. Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to seeing the future of this stuff.
All right.
Thank you.
Nice.